What stood out for you from this judgment? My name is Patrick Kadhara, and I am the chief curator at the LFA.
If it's rejecting a past and it is prescribing a future, what happens when that future is ignored? So, for example, if we say the Constitution is supreme and that is something that cannot be, is part of its basic structure, how do we end up with a judge who declares the chief administrative secretaries illegal, but they stay in office? Yes, we might say in paper we've got a basic structure of a constitution, but we don't have a constitutional government, quite honestly. Maybe at some level you can start and then I'll come to Marilyn.
Okay, so the challenge that we are confronted with now is the challenge of implementation and the challenge of the fact that historically we did not have a culture of constitutionalism. We have a culture where people did not respect the constitution and so did what they wanted to do. That's part of our past. And so we are now confronted with the challenge of implementation. And this is a challenge that is not going to end today. So it's important that, first of all, we get the principle. How do you get that principle? Is when you go to court and the court interprets, because that is the role of the court. The court interprets the constitution and says that this is or is not unconstitutional. Whether or not we are able to actually enforce those decisions is now a different battle. And right. In different jurisdictions, this has been handled differently. For example, in India, and I don't remember the name of the case, but we've had instances where they had the government disobeying the courts, and the courts would say that they would not hear the government when it would bring the government of the day, when it would bring a case to the court, because that same government will have to come back before the court. And so they would then say to them, until you purge yourself of this contempt, we will not hear you. And so there's different ways in which judiciaries deal with this issue. But the other aspect to this is actually the responsibility of the citizen. And these are some of the things I've been talking about. Because in terms of protecting the constitution, the judiciary is not the only arm of the state that has been given the responsibility. All these state officers, and make no mistake about it, every single elected person, anybody that holds an elective office under the 2010 constitution is a state officer. They are defined as a state officer. So whether they are an MCA, whether they are a member of the Senate, whether they're a member of the National Assembly, or they are a member of the cabinet, or they are, and the cabinet is not elected, but you know, they are appointed through the by the executive, or if they are the head of state, you know, the president or the deputy president, these are all state officers. They swear as part of their oath of office to protect the constitution. Now, we as Kenyans have to re-examine, it's something I've kept saying and I'm not going to stop saying it. We as Kenyans have to examine who it is that we elect, because we choose to put these people in office. When we choose to offer the opportunity to hold office, public office, when we choose to offer the privilege of holding electoral office to people who have consistently violated the constitution, or who have a history of engaging in acts that are illegalities, we are making a choice to actually undermine the constitution. And so to me, the undermining there of the constitution is not just by the political elite who we, you know, who we put in office, but it is also by us as a public.
The choices that we make.
Yeah, we are absconding our responsibility under Article 3 to protect the constitution. When we go to a ballot box and we knowingly choose somebody who we know has demonstrated time and time again that they won't respect the constitution. And so there is a value in having the decision. Whether or not we will be able to enforce that decision today is a different matter. But at least the decision is there. And we can, at some point in the future, rely on that decision.
I just wanted to mention here, because we've got people listening in and audience, you can put in any questions that you have for the panelists on the chat function, and we'll put them up. I'll pick them up from there, and I can I'll put them to the panelists. Marilyn, we've had this thing where I think the Supreme Court has said this before, and we've had others speak of progressive implementation
Of the Constitution. So it says this, but well, in times to come, we will do it. Mm-hmm. How does that sit with this idea of basic structure? Seems to me it kind of throws that out.
So I think, again, one of the things that happened was the political elite created narratives. And those narratives influenced judicial offices as well. I think that this is partly where, you know, the progressive realization came. We have the fifth schedule of the Constitution, where we needed to have certain legislation in place by 2015, 16, if there was an extension by a year. And so there was, it wasn't completely out of the blue to talk about progressive, but there was a framework. There was still a time-bound sense of certainty that by 2016 latest, we would be existing in this new state, right? I think for me, the challenge, and I think you posed a bigger question when to Atsango, which is sort of what happens when we sort of are going back to constitutions without constitutionalism, right?
Right.
We're kind of going back there with a judiciary that's helping us with decisions, but again, with two arms of government, the legislature and the executive, that are staunchly anti-constitution and anti-constitutionalism. The risks, I think, are that we are not ourselves taking time seriously. And that sounds like an odd thing to say, but and we've had this conversation with some people who we've been doing this public interest litigation with, which is that the state understands the value of time in eroding norms. They understand that very, very clearly. And so when a decision is suspended, when you get a suspended judgment and the CAS is still sitting in office, or the CSs who've been unconstitutional twice now are still sitting in office, what the state learns is it's okay, we can manage. When we go to court and we get orders that require parliament enact legislation within 60 days and they don't and nothing happens, it emboldens actors. And so part of the risk is that we ourselves as citizens are not taking time seriously, that we are not understanding that what is happening with the passage of time is the erosion of our norm. So I really liked the foundation example that Abu Bakr gave us. Mine's not going to be as good, but let's think of the Constitution as like a rock in a river. And time is the water, right? Mm-hmm. Over time, you know, water is going to erode the rock. And that's really what's happening. And, you know, I say this because a lot of women especially really called a crisis in like 14 and leading up to 15 before we got to the timeline for the fifth schedule. And we were really dismissed. And it was really, that was the time when we really needed to all have alarm bells ringing. And the next best time is now, right? The next best time for us to be saying, actually, perhaps we should really consider whether any of these state officers should even be eligible for public office in 2022. Yeah. I mean, if you cannot uphold these provisions, why are we risking this again? You know, what are we doing to ourselves? I think the bigger question you're really asking is, how do we as citizens get out of having a constitution that is then eroded by, you know, a lack of constitutionalism? How do citizens engage in upholding constitutions? And part of it is withdrawing support. I think we think too much about voting, but there is also the very, very basic things you can do. I've been telling people since like 2015, every time you submit memoranda to the National Assembly or Senate, your first point should be, and oh, by the way, you guys are unconstitutional. Oh, by the way, because part of what you're doing when you create this record is you're starting to say, when it matters, when we want to come back. And I always say the people who will fight this fight, for whom it will matter, will probably, by the way, be corporations. You'll find some corporation at some point is going to decide, you know what, that tax rate, that law that was passed, wait a second, Parliament is unconstitutional. They didn't meet the two-thirds gender rule. They don't care about the two-thirds gender rule.
Right.
It's going to be in their interest at that point. So part of how we do it is this systematic erosion as well. The same way they use time, we have to use time. We can't have sporadic episodic engagement, which is kind of what we've been doing as citizens.
Right, and I think Waikwa again to, I just want to push a little bit on this thing of progressive implementation, because I think if you've got a constitution, it says you've got to do this by this time. And then that time comes and it's pushed back, you know, and eventually it's not implemented. You know, it seems to me it negates the whole point of having that of having that provision, of having that thing. So shouldn't we be in the position of saying, if there is indeed a basic idea underlying or basic structure underlying the Constitution and it is not complied with, that it's time to talk about consequences rather than thinking about giving people more time to implement it?
Yeah, so there are a number of things in terms of how to deal with that. There has been discussion about the role of citizens in terms of being vigilant and in terms of demanding that the Constitution be complied with. And I think way back, Mililin started us on the issue of lack of imagination. And then Asango has talked about how citizens themselves have facilitating the frustration of the Constitution. For me, how the politicians seem to be winning, because for me, they are not necessarily winning. And the reason why they are not necessarily winning, even though it may look like they're winning in the short term, is court orders are not perishable. And so as long as you have vigilant citizens, 10 years from now, things people are doing today, they could have be held accountable for. Rachel Shebesh, who is being paid illegal salary as a CAS with a Babuna Mwamba, there might be a time when we will go and ask that they return that money, because there's already a judgment that says that those are illegal position. And remember, under the Constitution, accountability is individual, it's not corporate. And so people need to know that. However, I still, but the second point about citizens is, and politicians, this contestation, is citizens also now have to take charge. What the politicians have done, and especially Uhuru has been very, very good at this, is to create narratives that instill psychological trauma on citizens. If you look at what they called reggae with Raila Odinga, reggae was actually an instrument of psychological trauma. I was surprised yesterday attending the elections conference that even fairly informed people still are talking about a referendum, possibility of a referendum happening before the 2022 general elections. And what people don't seem to appreciate is that they were subjected to so much trauma, they are still recovering from the notion of the indispensability of a referendum. These are traumatized people. And the citizens need to give themselves or to do self-help and now reclaim the narrative and say, no, no, this is what's going to happen and these are our priority. But coming to implementation of the judgment, of course, one of the things I get really frustrated about when we litigate these cases is the fact that a lot of these judgments are good. A lot of them end up diagnosing the problem and providing the best way to resolve it. But when it comes to the actual remedy, that's where they suspend. And it's hard sometimes for me not to think that at some point, judges feel this is too much, this is too dramatic. And so the question becomes, what do we need to do to give the judges the next level of energy they need to be able to actually say, no, enough is enough, and it's now. It's not tomorrow. We are not suspending the judgment. And partly why BBI judgment is so fundamental is because it didn't seek to suspend anything. Even the illegality of IBC, that was suspended not in the judgment, but just based on an application that was made in court after the judgment. So you can see, and yet after that judgment, you can see how much people have seen the possibilities that we can have with the Constitution. Can you imagine if the same thing was said about CAS? Can you imagine if the court, because it's not the court's problem at some level, to say, they only say this is what the law says and this is where we end. The court said, you have to fix parliament because that's what the Constitution requires. So I think we need to move to the next level. But let's also not forget, in public service, nobody is doing more work than people in the judiciary. A lot of us don't appreciate how much work judges and magistrates carry. And we also have to be realistic in terms of the demands we put in on them. Of course, the Constitution has already put those demands. So the best we can do is to lighten the load for them by actually protecting their space and protecting what they're doing and defending them when they come under attack and demanding, for example, now that Uhuru should be appointing the six judges. In fact, citizens need to remember, because Parliament has refused to impeach Uhuru, which is the remedy that the citizens have to an unperforming serial violator of a constitution in a president. Citizens need to invoke Article 118 and draft their own articles of impeachment. Let Parliament refuse to act on citizens.
Citizens can act.
Let's defend the judiciary.
You've addressed one of the questions that we got from on the chat, which was about the ruling on IEBC as not having a quorum, as being essentially illegal. But I think the corollary to that, and maybe Abubakar, you can start us off on this, is if I think it's a question about the effect of the judgment. So now they have said this. It's been said at the high level, at the court. At the high court level, it's being appealed, and because of that, some of its effects, I think, have been suspended. What happens if it is upheld? You know, does now that mean that, for example, all the elections that the IEBC has been overseeing suddenly become illegal? You know, and does that mean then we have to go back to all these by-elections and start again? You know, my second thing is, would it then be, would it apply to all other courts, basically all the other high courts, if somebody went in with another mention? The reason I ask this is we've got a high court judgment that says police cannot take you to court and then say you're held as they go look for they look for evidence, basically as they complete investigations. The High Court said that was illegal, but other courts have been allowing police to do this, you know, keep doing it. So my question again is, what's the actual effect of this judgment going forward? Will it become something that is precedent setting that everybody else has to apply to? And looking back again at the IBC issue, does that mean we have to redo all the elections that the IBC has overseen?
Let's start step by step, and I'll make a reference to what the others have spoken to. When a court order is given, it's not supposed to be in theory. That what do I mean? That if you are a state officer and you have sworn to uphold the Constitution, and the court has made a ruling that touches on you, it is incumbent upon you to resign. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these things are very personal. How do you justify staying in an office that has been declared unconstitutional? Let's forget about what the others are saying. Let's talk about personal responsibility that is accruing to every public official, to every state officer. If it has been said the office you hold is unconstitutional, your integrity should demand of you to say, I resign. I cannot continue drawing a salary and allowances and pretend I'm working, yet what I am doing is illegal. It's unconstitutional. By the way, Gadara, I'm a sociologist. I'm not a lawyer.
Right.
I'm a sociologist. So let me speak again from that perspective, meaning what? We need to go a step further. In many jurisdictions, we have realized that until somebody is held accountable at a personal level, mm-hmm. People will hide behind institutional frameworks.
Right.
So what do? We must go back to court and say, because somebody who was mentioned in a court order to do a specific thing and they refuse to obey the court order, then we should ask for that person, he or she, to be held in contempt.
Right.
Of a court order.
Mm-hmm.
And we should ask relief from the court. I know I talked about pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But let's go to the next issue I wanted to talk about, which is this idea of the not more than two-thirds of the same gender.
Right.
Judgment by the Supreme Court. First of all, we must say that was a majority decision.
Mm-hmm.
And to some of us, the minority decision was the one which made sense. Mm-hmm. But the architecture of our judiciary is such that the Supreme Court has the power to revisit its own decision. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another avenue that we can go to. And particularly bearing in mind all the matters that required progressive approach, we mentioned them by name in the Constitution. Those matters that require progressively, we mentioned them by name. Mm-hmm. So they departed from that philosophy and they decided to add to the list of what they consider.
Right. But now hopefully they can go back and relook at this. I really want to get to the questions that are being asked here. So Sarah Kimani of SABC News asks about the claims that this is judicial activism and that civil society are sponsoring these rulings. Perhaps, Chasoni, you can quickly just address that and we'll move on from it.
One of the biggest mysteries for me post the 2010 Constitution is this whole notion of judicial activism. I actually don't know what that phrase means. I hear it tossed around quite a bit. So I may be the person that is most incompetent to answer this. My own interpretation of the phrase is that there's a bunch of people that think that, you know, when they call people activists, it's a dirty word and that they're insulting them. And so their way of demeaning judges who rule in a way in which they don't agree with is to call them activists.
Right.
I don't know that my own interpretation, because I do think there's actually a theory, and there I will defer to Waikwa, who I think is a bit more competent, holding a PhD.
Waikwa, what do you think?
In some of these matters, I will leave it there. I will then say on whether or not civil society is sponsoring it. Again, it is part of the same culture of propaganda.
Demonizing civil society.
Yeah, some of us who are members of civil society who then went on to ask questions about certain types of injustices at one point in time were labeled evil. And so, you know, it's part of the propaganda and part of the way in which the political elite is attempting to cast aspersion on the bench simply because they don't agree with the decision.
All right. Waikwa, what do you think about judicial activism?
It's actually constitutional activism. It's not judicial activism.
Right.
In fact, what we probably have in Kenya is a little bit conservative at the judiciary level, because when we actually even talking about, for example, judgments and the fact that judges at some point feel like they can go beyond a certain point, that is conservatism. When we talked, Atango just talking about the two-third gender advisory, the majority of judges at the Supreme Court actually chose to be conservative because the Constitution was relatively clear about timelines and obligations. And in fact, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in now if the judges had not been conservative. So the Constitution is actually more activist than our judges. It's the judges who need to catch up. that's our dilemma at the moment.
Right. Marilyn, there's a question about judges postponing implementation of their decisions and whether that amounts to undermining the supremacy of the Constitution. I think this was actually, he is referring to the issue of the CASs. But I think also to what I had asked previously about the effect of this particular judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if it is upheld, and we've had an IEBC that's been running by-elections, are all those by-elections then automatically voided?
So I think the simple answer would be yes. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things we need to do, though, is reframe that question. And because this is, it is framed in that way so that judges can balk and say, oh my God, that's just too big. And I think the reframing of that would be, when is it in the public interest to maintain unconstitutionality? You know, we have a framing problem. Because what the state is basically asking us to do is, you know, we go out and we violate all these laws and we know they're violations. And then we come here and we say, but you know, it's going to be so much work to undo this, you know. And so part of what we're developing, I think, is a jurisprudence that is defining public interest to include unconstitutionality. Because how else do you say that you can maintain clearly unconstitutional action? In the public interest, right? Or in deference to one branch of government. So I do think that the answer would be yes, but I don't think that that's a bad answer. I think what that does is, I used to say that I thought the idea was to get us to such a big constitutional crisis that we abandoned the Constitution of Kenya altogether. And to be honest, I'm not so sure that we're still that far off, because part of what this intractability is, the IEBC is unconstitutional, Parliament is unconstitutional, the executive at cabinet level is unconstitutional, mm-hmm. Supreme Court just became constitutional you know, a month ago. Part of what that was a check on each other. All these unconstitutional bodies were protecting each other. So in part, the Supreme Court's constitutionality is a threat to the continued existence of these other unconstitutional bodies. And we do need to be careful about that, that we do not then revert back to, okay, how do we get everybody back in the same boat, you know, so that we're all unconstitutional together. We are in a crisis. It does mean that the remedial measures that need to be taken are significant. But postponing it is not going to make it better. It's like saying, I'm not going to go for my, you know, I have a tumor in my breast. I feel it. I really should go for a biopsy, but I'm not going to go because it might be bad. As if I go 3 years later, it's going to be a better result. You know, I really think that's where we are.
Okay. I think there's a question here for Zane that directly for you. It says, what is the role of national culture and constitutionalism in breaking the culture of impunity, corruption, and other misfortunes ailing Kenya? I think you've discussed a little bit about it, but maybe you could give us a quick short answer.
Simple, three things. One, in the constitution making process, we accepted that culture is an important imperative in the constitutional framework. But unfortunately, the cultural, many of the cultural provisions were edited out and taken out as part of the political deal in Naivasha. We had a whole chapter on culture. We had an institutional framework for implementing culture, but that was taken out. But the second aspect is that when Professor Ogendo talked about having constitution without constitutionalism, part of it was that because we have not internalized the values and the philosophy of that constitution, and we have made it part of us, and we want to leave it, to leave them. And when I was making reference to personal responsibility to some of these state institutions, we also have to ask those who your composition has been said does not have constitutional mandate because of quorum issues, but you are still meeting and making decisions.
Right.
So again, how do you, until we are able to extend this personal responsibility to people who do that, then it is very difficult. But two final things, we must continue with civic education. We must seek to inculcate constitutional history and development as part of our education system, and touch people young. If we are not able to do that, you will still have people. It's called a culture of impunity. Mm-hmm. But also, let me add one last word on the question of activism. If you agree that the 2010 constitution is a transformative constitution, then it means that it is demanding of people to embrace change and transformation. So when you do embrace it, it doesn't mean that you are being activist. You are actually obeying the constitution.
Right. We have a question here from Dennis Esikuri, and he asks, should we have many civil society members join political spaces, win elective seats, and fight from within parliament for legislation and passing progressive bills? You see, I think he's asking whether we should be taking the fight to defend the constitution into parliament by ourselves, choosing to participate in electoral politics. I mean, I would preface that question by just noting that the record of people we've sent to parliament has not really been encouraging. So I don't know, maybe Zain, you could start with that, and then we could ask Chisodi as well.
again, let's go back to our constitution, okay?
Right.
The constitution says that the people of Kenya exercises their sovereignty directly or through their democratically elected representatives. Let's start with directly. We didn't tell people this, but we have constitutionalized mass action. And we know that that's our history. That's how we got this constitution. So the right to assemble, the right to protest, the right to picket. You know, people think protesting and picketing is the same. Picketing is much more, picketing is much more robust. You could go and say, we are going to make a particular office occupy it. You know, occupy, this occupation mentality is part of our constitution now.
Right.
But also, as somebody said, elections, participating in elections directly is also our responsibility. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that we cannot run for election. I can tell you, we have very many examples of a few good men and women who were able to operate in a much more difficult time in parliament and fight for democratization within parliament. I don't know how many people remember the story of the bearded sisters in courts.
Right.
And a few people who stood up. So you don't need a lot of people. You only need a critical mass of people going into these spaces. Until and unless, because politics in Kenya has been made to look very bad, good people are shying away from seeking to serve. The same way people are demonizing judiciary, it will reach a time you may end up having good people not wanting to go to the judiciary because the way they are treated. So I'm saying, please, let's not give up. Let's go into the spaces and let's go and work. And the last thing, don't see going to public service as an end in itself that after that, I don't want to work anymore. No, go and make your contribution and implement this constitution properly. And when you leave, continue working. This All idea right. of seeing a public office as a place to make money is the wrong place.
Let me just, Asango, just first ask Waikwa, because I know he's got to leave fairly soon. Just in terms of this shift of people saying, let's get better people into parliament, because as the discussion has noted, it's one of the spaces where the defense of the constitution is not happening. Would that be an effective way of changing things? Or do we need to do more than simply electing better people?
And I apologize. I have to leave. The other panelists knew this, but your listeners didn't. The question for me, the starting point is, who are good and bad people? So judges have done very well. We've talked about it within the same country. Is it that judges are drawn from a different crop of people or a different country? No. But why is it that the judiciary, relative to other institutions, have done very well, even relative to independent commissions? It's, for me, the solution is not the people. The solution is the institution. How do you build institutions? How do you create transformative institutions? How do you create a culture of transformation? How do you make people, when they come to an institution, know that, as has been stated, you're not becoming an MP. That is not the end, it's a means. And what is that purpose? What's your purpose? And that is what the judiciary seemed to do fairly well. And I think we fail to credit the leadership of the judiciary in this sense, in terms of, for example, when you go to the Willie Mutunga's tenure, the fact he came up with the transformation, I think they call it judiciary transformation framework, and then Justice Maraga continued with that, and we keep hoping that Justice Koome will also accelerate that, or at least make sure that she continues to instill the constitutional culture within the judiciary. If Muturi, Justin Muturi had a vision and a purpose as the speaker, he would have created rules and a culture that would have made our parliament first and foremost independent, because we forget parliament also is supposed to be independent. Dignified. We don't have a dignified parliament. Can you imagine how painful it is for people like Orengo and Otiende, who, if we were thinking about good people, these are the people we would be thinking of sending to parliament.
Right.
How painful and indignifying it is for them to say, you know what, Senator Omogeni, you know what, this bill is unconstitutional. But when it comes to voting, yes.
Yeah.
At some level, you also have to sympathize with that person. The institution and the political arrangements have debased and indignified them to that level that they don't have any personal or professional pride. That's what our judges have that our MPs don't have. So how do we create those institutions that make those who work there to feel secure and also to feel that they have a stake, not just personal, but institutional and beyond, to protect that institution and perpetuate the good that that institution should be doing. The president, how do we make the president honor the constitution? Of course, some people are irredeemable. So that is a problem.
You spoke before about having judgments that are very good at analyzing the problems and not as good at giving us a remedy. So what is your remedy?
My remedy is that Kenyans have to find ways to insist that we have to build proper institutions. Think why we've lost the Independent Commission. Because we allowed Uhuru to use the independent commissions to reward people who lost political power. That's how people like Priscilla Nyokabi are in the gender commission. And that's why she has to go around parroting BBI and even justifying Uhuru not performing a constitutional obligation of appointing judges. And we have more examples. It's not just Priscilla Nyokabi. Let's insist. And whenever there is an attack on an institution, let actually gang up and protect that institution. And we can start by protecting the judiciary and giving it the space to work. I really have to apologize that I have to leave at this point.
No problem. Thanks a lot for coming. This really enjoyed having you on. We'll continue with the other participants, the other panelists are here. Thanks a lot for being part of it.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Asango, let me come to you and ask about this push to say, let's put in people. You've said that it's about who we elect. We shouldn't elect serial abusers of the constitution. But in as much as we try to change people, they always seem to revert to this norm, you know, and Waiko has mentioned a bit about it. So what is left for the citizen who wants to defend this constitution? You know, is it simply go to the streets, or, you know, how else can he participate in ensuring, for example, the legislature upholds the constitution?
I think Abu had spoken earlier about how this is, you know, transformation is not overnight, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I disagree slightly. It's a pity Waiko wasn't able to be with us. I disagree that it's just about the institutions. When I was younger, I used to think it was just about the institutions. Successfully having promulgated a new constitution, which created strong institutions, for me, I am very clear today that when you have a nascent democracy, when you have nascent institutions, who holds office also matters. And so some of the kind of things we should be doing, and I don't think that we will get good leadership just from civil society. Having been in civil society, having had to undertake work where I was studying different things about civil society, there are individuals who were in civil society who I can tell you for a fact were corrupt, for example.
Right.
And if some of those people go into public office, they won't behave any differently. So I think we need to, whenever people put themselves forward for public office, we need to look at who they were before. We don't just look at who they are today or the banner that they picked up yesterday or in the past couple of months on the way to preparing themselves. So we need to continue with the work of creating a critical mass of the kind of people that we think should be in office. We need to look at the way in which we should be putting together lists, for example, of if tomorrow offices come up, you know, that, you know, whereby people should be nominated. Do we have lists of people who we think are the kind of caliber of people that should, you know, that should be put there, or that should apply? When people are appointed, Waiko had just mentioned the gender commission. The manner in which the current gender commissioners, with all due respect, were appointed was very clandestine.
Right.
That process itself should have been challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we keep also insisting on transparent processes, on processes that ensure that people come into, first of all, that the opportunity to apply for a position is one that is public, because the Constitution is very clear about that. So that people who actually have the appropriate credentials and competences are given the opportunities. All these things will make a difference. So for me, it's a number of different things. And I think it is opening ourselves to the fact that good people can be found everywhere. It's not just in one particular sub, it's not just in one particular subsector. And what we should be insisting on is that we, for any form of public office, that the people that are under consideration and that have the opportunity to serve are people of integrity, people who have demonstrated themselves to be people of integrity. And that when people abuse public office, they also bear sanctions. There's nothing that prevents us, for example, if somebody, you know, earned a salary that they should not have earned, there's nothing that prevents us from suing them.
Right. Get
the, you know, under the that, old constitution, there are people who were detained, who went to court before 2010 and sued Moi, whilst Moi was still alive and still a person that was powerful.
Right.
And so with this constitution, we have even more instruments. And it's not just the individuals who are directly affected. There is one additional benefit. With this constitution, we can, under the Bill of Rights, where it's a rights violation, sue on behalf of people who, for some reason, cannot institute measures.
Right.
But we do...
If I may ask Marilyn about the sort of the institution of parliament and accountability for them. You know, I think if one of the things we want to be able to do is to force parliament to essentially do our bidding, then we've got to be able to hold them to account. But one of the main ways that we are supposedly enabled to do that is by being able to recall them, but they've then gone about and rubbished it, how we are to do it, the law they passed to activate that part of the Constitution went. I would think that's a fairly fundamental bit of the Constitution might be covered by this whole basic structure bit. But how do we go about ensuring that it is actually done? We as citizens, you've been quite involved in pushing for, you know, declarations and stuff in court. How can we take this fight to parliament?
So I think we go back to, you know, where the Constitution locates power, and the Constitution locates power in the people, right? And I think that that's really sort of where we are again. So part of how we have to do the accountability work, and I agree it is both individual and institutional, I think both matter. But as somebody who's a perennial outsider, I seem to never be an insider. I think I can speak much better to how to work it outside. And I think part of what you do when you're outside the system is you're holding space. And sometimes you're holding space actively with court cases. Other times you're really just holding space waiting for the next people to come and just take the baton from you because you're just tired as all hell. You know, and it is important that we are, as Abubakar was saying, we are clear that this is a process, that we are passing through this time. And what we should be very, very clear about as well, I think, is we must keep that imagination of where we are going alive. Because if we do not keep that imagination alive, if we keep front and center the violations, the indignity, the really the trampling of the Constitution, if we keep that too large, too visible, if that picture is vibrant and clear, then we can't see where we're going. And so part of our job and part of the resistance is literally keeping an imagination alive, keeping that vision alive. And it can seem like it's futile. And I think this is one of the ways that I think we really need to be grateful to artists, you know, people who write fiction, poetry, you know, songs. I'm thinking about A Kenyan Message by Muthoni the Drummer Queen. You know, I mean, we've had all these people basically capturing what we feel and sort of holding that space for us. And again, I think this is the culture bit. This is the way we can change it, that they can't control as much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the judgments, we will continue to do that. There are those of us who can do that. But as individuals, anyone who's on Twitter knows that people are constantly sending Boniface Mwangi DMs. Yeah. Boniface Mwangi has no elected position, yet he seems to have more power than many MPs. Mm-hmm. So there is power that is located outside of political position. And we as citizens are also giving it, because when you're sending Boniface Mwangi a DM, you're saying, I know that you can do things.
Right,
so the power is both agenda setting power, but it's also the power to actualize things. And I think one of the things that the legislature is not taking seriously enough is the longer that you are unresponsive to citizens, the more that that power is going to be distributed to other places.
Right.
So, because the citizens are going to look for answers. You know, I think that's part of also how we're starting to see, you know, it's again, a bit of that self-help. It can be a bit dangerous, vigilantism, but it is a response to, this is where we've located our representative power. You're not responding appropriately. We will withdraw it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important way to think about it. It's not legal, but I mm-hmm. think that is the analysis of power. Power is wielded to do things, to actualize things for citizens. And we need to return, I think, to an analysis of power that's more service-focused and citizen-focused.
Right. We're coming to the tail end of this. And I want us to kind of also look forward. We've got an appeal process now going, and it should be done, I think they said, by next week. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think is likely to come out of that? Is it your expectation that if it is not upheld, this would end up at the Supreme Court? Maybe we start with you, Zane, and then just do a quick round with everybody else.
Yeah. So in terms of scenario building, it's not just me. I think many commentators have said that the way the judgment is constructed and it's reasoned and it's written, it's going to be a very steep curve to completely vacate it, as you the word you used. But there are three possible outcomes. You can have a situation where the Court of Appeal affirms the findings of the High Court. Then you can have a situation where it vacates it. So those are the two extreme ones, affirmation, right, vacation. But in between, you have a possibility of some of the issues being vacated and some being affirmed. Now, when you have that third scenario where there's a mixed bag, you then have to analyze and say, do they have an effect to completely change the outcome and make BBI kosher? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. If, for example, they only focus on small peripheral matters to deal with the conduct of the president and apply a saving grace kind of right. philosophy on that, still it doesn't make change the outcome. But the fourth right. dimension to this is that parties that are dissatisfied with the outcome of the Court of Appeal will always have an option to go to the Supreme Court. So again, it's a process. But let me say two things, Gadara, before we go. One, many constitutions do not have chapters on leadership and integrity. Because we in Kenya identified leadership as a challenge and integrity as a challenge in our society. That's why we constructed a whole chapter called Leadership and Integrity. So that right. speaks volumes in terms of what deficit we have. But I also agree with those who have spoken and say, that we need to focus on the cultural dimension. And to finish, I say, there are three important processes as far as this constitution is concerned. The first one is deconstruction of the past, that we must continue to deconstruct, and we must continue to find new ways of telling our history, our memory, and what went on in our country up to now. The second one is constructing the future. This is a continuation conversation that we are having. And then the third one is the transition between the construction and construction of the future.
Right.
So I think sometimes we are too hard on ourselves. We only think of the things that are not working. We are not looking at how far we have come. There was a time there was detention without trial in this country.
The time so, we couldn't have this conversation.
This conversation will lead to incarceration.
Right, exactly. So Atsango, for you, way forward, what do you see happening? And what would you like to see happen?
I think the easiest is for me to answer, what would I like?
Right.
I would love a situation where the Court of Appeal completely upholds this judgment. In my opinion, this judgment was affirming, and I completely agree with Waikwa when he said that this is the most historical judgment we have received, because it was dealing with the Constitution in its totality. But more importantly for me, it was affirming the citizen as sovereign. And right. So regardless of how things go at the Court of Appeal, I think the very fact that Kenyans actually saw that there is a place where they can go, if they feel that the political elite are not listening, are refusing completely to respect what we all agreed to be bound by, the fact that Kenyans have seen repeatedly that there is a place they can go and speak out about this, and that that can be upheld, that principle that nobody actually is above the law, because that's what this did, that's what this affirmed indirectly, Kenyans understood that the person who holds the most powerful office in this country is not above the law.
Exactly, he has to comply.
Yeah, that just like everybody else, he has to comply, that he's a citizen. Right. That message at the psychological level is a very important, message, and there's no gainsaying.
And actually, it goes to what you were saying before about the language, because there's a lot of people who talk, who said the judges were being disrespectful to the president. But this sort of refusal to kowtow to him, to sort of accord him this status, even after he has violated the constitution, perhaps is also a message to people about the status in which we hold people who carry elected office.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, in the matter of the constitution, the president is a citizen. Like the rest of us. There is no super citizen in the matter of the constitution. We all are one, regardless of our age, regardless of our ability or disability, regardless of our gender, regardless of all of that. So for me, that is for me what's most important about the about this decision, that it has forced us into a place whereby this conversation has been had and it has affirmed the centrality and the sovereignty of the citizens. And so let me stop there so that Marilyn has an opportunity.
All right. So Marilyn, we began with you 2 hours ago. You will end up, we'll have the final word. What do you see going forward? What is it I would like to see, and especially about the effect this would have across? Do you think it would change how people relate to government, how Kenyans see their government, or will it just be another blip and we quickly forget about it?
So I think it's already changed how we relate to government. I think it's already changed what people think is possible. And that's what, in my view, historic and precedent-setting decisions do, is they change your real world. And if they've changed the real world of ordinary Kenyans, then even if it is overturned on appeal, that moment isn't overturned. It doesn't change your mindset, right? And I think that's what I found really exciting about this judgment. The day after it, I remember speaking to a friend of mine and telling them I needed to go out. I needed to be in a place that was huge. Like I needed to be in the forest. I actually went to the forest. I really felt like this was, oh my God, I couldn't have imagined it, you know? And so you don't take that moment away by overturning a decision. So in one way, I'm actually quite uninvested in the appellate process. That's why. But secondly, and I Waikwa spoke about this, there is no realistic legal way for us to have a referendum before the 2022 election. That is the real impact of this decision. And I think that that's one of the things we need to be saying very consistently and very loudly, because, you know, undoing that narrative means that then we can start preparing for the 2022 election. Because part of this appellate process is to keep us invested in a referendum, a possible referendum that legally we cannot have before the next general election. So I think for me, that's the way I choose to look at this judgment. But I do want us to just, I wanted to say this, I don't know why I didn't say it before, but I would be remiss not to talk about the fact that two of those judges are on the list of the six that the president refused to appoint, has unconstitutionally refused to appoint, and actually in violation of court orders. There's no stay, although there's an appellate, there's an appeal to the Court of Appeal. And that one of the ways in which we can be vigilant about defending constitutionalism is to protect the individuals who actually do the work. Because while we may not always be able to have consequences for the violators, to throw people who choose to uphold individual and institutional integrity and the national values, to throw them completely under the bus, would also be to undermine our own long-term aspirations. So I just wanted to make sure I said that for the record.
That's great and very well said. Thanks a lot to all our participants. I think it's been a really fascinating discussion. Thanks Marion Kamuru, Atsango Chesoni, Abubakar Zain, and Waikwa Wanyoike who had with that. Thanks a lot everybody for being part of this, and we shall see you next time.